From the Sky News Centre at 6, the family of Premier League footballer Emiliano Sala say it's with infinite sadness they discover the body found in a plane in the English Channel is his. They say their thoughts are also with the relatives of pilot David Ibbotson, who's still not been found since the aircraft came down last month. A convicted killer who murdered a vulnerable woman and dismembered her body has been told he'll serve at least 28 years behind bars. Andrew Wallace attacked 47-year-old Julie Riley at her flat in the Govan area of Glasgow in February last year. When he was 15, the 42-year-old was sentenced to 10 years for culpable homicide for stabbing a 51-year-old woman to death. Lynn Bryce, Julie's sister, has made this appeal to the killer.
I hope that if he has a heart, if you could now please tell us where he has put my sister and let her come home to be put to rest properly and the dignity she deserves.
A woman and a man have been arrested in connection with a house fire in Stafford that killed four young children. They're being held on suspicion of manslaughter by gross negligence. Five-time Oscar nominee Albert Finney has died at the age of 82 from a short illness. He's best known for roles in Erin Brockovich and Annie. He reportedly turned down a knighthood. Dave Calhoun is a film critic.
He actually described himself as lower middle class. Those early films he did in the 60s, which he was associated with, were really about bringing working class stories to the fore in a way, and on the screen in the way they hadn't before. So I imagine for him, taking a knighthood would be turning his back on his early days and his early film roles.
It's understood two no-confidence motions in Labour MP and outspoken Jeremy Corbyn critic Luciana Berger have been withdrawn. She's previously criticised the leader of her party over his handling of anti-Semitism and his position on Brexit. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
Busy. This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George, Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. Labour Party activist Mal Sainsbury's here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Donald Trump's State of the Disunion. The wall and ramping up the tension and the arms race with Russia. It doesn't matter what people vote for, America apparently can never be a socialist country. But why? Also Venezuela, the elected President Maduro is condemned both in the UK and the US and by the European Union. What has he done wrong? And why does the favourite to be the next president of Europe have to... What does he have to say about Alexis Tsipras? The Greek Prime Minister has dared to support Maduro. Who is this guy, Manfred Weber, anyway? A war of words between the French and Italian government. Not seen since the days of Mussolini, apparently. Why are Italian government finding common cause with the Gilets Jaunes? Protesters right across France have been meeting, I think it's now 12 weeks in a row, every Saturday and Sunday. Plus, we take a more serious and closer look at Lloyds Bank's business support unit here in Bristol. Avon and Somerset Police have come under intense criticism this week through the Police and Crime Panel for not properly investigating evidence of alleged fraud at the unit. With scores of people losing their livelihoods as a result. They occupy the old Bank of England Bristol offices on the edge of Castle Park, and calls this week for our Police Commissioner Stu Mount-Stevens to resign for not pulling the Chief Constable up and getting these frauds investigated by the unit. Alleged frauds, I should say. We hear from a Lloyds Bank victim tonight who used to advise the government on property fraud. That's all in the second hour after the Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 7 Celsius, light rain and windy. This weekend, highs around 10, light rain and showers all weekend, I'm afraid, and also windy. Next week, Highs around 10. Showers on Monday. Sunny spells, though, the rest of the week. So weather easing off as the week goes on. Next weekend, 16th and 17th of February, highs around 7 Celsius again. Sunny spells next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Fabian Breckles. Hi, Fabian. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, nice to be back.
Labour councillor and property owner. We'll be talking about property fraud in the second hour, Fabian, but I might ask you, I don't know if you've seen any of the coverage this week of this meeting of the police and crime panel. What they're alleging is that Lloyds Bank has not been being investigated properly by Avon and Somerset Police, and that effectively the police here are a soft touch because this unit, this Lloyds Bank's unit, is based in Bristol, that they're not investigating it as much as they might do in other parts of the country. They've actually got criticism as well from the Police and Crime Commissioner in Thames Valley Police, who says that he's prepared to help it do these investigations here in Avon and Somerset, but both the police and the Police and Crime Commissioner have turned his requests and offers down.
Well, without hearing their side of the argument, it would be very difficult to comment. Obviously, if there is if there's alleged wrongdoing, then it obviously needs to be investigated, or should be investigated. What I do know, because I did attend a ride along with the police an afternoon last month, is that they are incredibly stretched. Government funding, you know, cuts to government funding for the police means they are incredibly stretched. So response cars can be literally sent. Emergency, you know, cars can be literally sent from one side of the city to the other simply because there's no one else to deal with stuff. It's, you know, so they are, the police here are doing the best they can with very, very little resource. So that's going to be, make investigating anything more, you know, such as a fraud, potential fraud case, more of a challenge. But so obviously,
anyway, the upshot of it is the Police and Crime Panel have decided to have their own investigation into whether the police have been doing their job properly. Mal, what's your thoughts on this, if we just kick off with this? Because I think maybe what I'll do is I'll just literally play the little piece from Points West early this week, where we hear a bit of an introduction. Maybe you can comment after we've heard from Points West on Tuesday this week. And apparently the Lloyds lawyers have been leaning very heavily on the BBC at all sorts of levels in order to try and stop this being reported.
Victims of an alleged multi-million pound fraud by Lloyds Bank in Bristol claim that Avon and Somerset Police have refused to investigate their allegations.
They told a heated meeting of the Police and Crime Panel, which scrutinises complaints about the force, that the Police and Crime Commissioner herself was failing to do her job properly. Steve Brodie reports.
We either want police officers arrested or we want mandamus orders that hold people to their oath and their public duty to stand down. And
that's Trevor Melam is one of the thousands of victims who say their lives are ruined by Lloyds Bank, which they claim deliberately forced their businesses and farms to close in order to recover millions of pounds in loans and fees.
What I will say is Mrs. Mount Stevens doesn't know her role.
He clashed with members of the panel as he hammered home his message that the police and the PCC, Sue Mount Stevens, were at fault. The victim's claims are backed by Anthony Stansfeld, the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley Police. The PCC offered to help Avon and Somerset investigate the allegations, but his offer was turned down. Mr. Stansfeld told the BBC, I have considerable concerns that the vast majority of allegations made to Avon and Somerset Police have not been properly investigated.
I'm sorry to hear that the people are not happy with this response. I've had assurances from the Chief Constable that the police will continue to evaluate any correspondence from individuals who are unhappy with the outcomes, and wherever new evidence is received, the police will review it.
In a sudden change of heart, the panel decided it would hold its own investigation, stating there are questions to be asked.
We need an outsider to investigate, and that's exactly what we need. We're very suspicious of what's going on.
I think it's a very positive move forward, and thank the chairman for his help.
Throughout a three-year-long BBC investigation, Lloyds Bank has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. Avon and Somerset Police have also concluded that no crimes had been committed by the bank and its agents.
Well, I mean, I suppose the other way of looking at this, Mal, might be that this is just sour grapes by people who've taken out loans that they just simply couldn't repay.
Well, it could be, or it could be that people's voices and complaints are getting louder and louder and not having the answers that they're looking for. And I mean, Lloyds is actually quite a major, it's a major headquarters here, isn't it? And the more powerful the organisation, the more they're able to somehow resist the kind of investigation that perhaps is needed.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that after the financial crisis in 2008, the bailout, where we gave Lloyds Bank and various other banks rather a lot of money, they then decided that they had to make more money, and there was a lot of pressure put on them to come up with results. Now, that might mean saying, well, here's a whole bunch of loans, let's just call them in, and then we can make instant profit on those, and other people, you know, the people who've taken those loans out might be the victims.
Well, you know, bankers, since 2008, we've looked on them as the villains, haven't we? And it's very strange to me how they all these financial transactions that are carried on, no real money is actually involved. We're talking about promises and words on paper. And to actually pull out from people with small businesses is actually to ruin the whole of their lives. Mm. So to call in these kind of monies because you somehow have to make your books balance, it's not real money. I mean, there's obviously some sort of ethical thing there that's, you know, not being sorted out.
You seem to be implying that Lloyds Bank have got some sort of little horticulture business going on, like a little magic money tree business going
on. Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? The magic money tree, like the magic voting tree, isn't it? No, I do think that we should have very transparent ways of investigating financiers, bankers particularly, because we know we did bail out, it was the Royal Bank of Scotland, it belongs, yep. Is it 64% to us? And when I think about all these transactions that go on, and we've got hand-in-glove things that go on with people, and I feel very suspicious indeed that, in fact, it's not being, you know, there's not an alacrity here where people are going to be called to account and say, oh, we're doing the best we can, but in actual fact, not fast enough for some of those people whose lives have been ruined.
I think we're going to return to the subject of bankers before the end of this first hour. I've got a bit of audio of Mark Carney this week, the Governor of the Bank of England, taking us through what he thinks is going to be the economic results of the uncertainty over Brexit. But, Mel, I'll let you introduce Drew, because you've asked her to come along this evening.
I have. I've asked Drew Marland, who's an artist, illustrator, and a very fine writer, to come along, because she's a trans woman friend of mine who... we were hoping today to have a look at the suggestions, consultation and the responses to the tweakings of the Gender Recognition Act, because, you know, that whole thing about don't talk about us without us. And we're talking about a very tiny minority of people who, you know, perhaps lives are going to be made a bit easier by this. And I'm very aware that there are small pockets of people who are a little bit worried about it. So hi, Drew.
Hello, Mel. Small but increasing pockets, I'm afraid. Yeah, there seems to be a very strong anti-trans propaganda campaign going on at the moment.
Really? Give me some examples of it.
Fundamentally, the response to the proposed reform of the GRA, the Gender Recognition Act, focuses mostly on the idea of predatory men in toilets.
Dressing up in frocks and all that kind of thing.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
So these are concerns of people. It's scaremongering going on here, do you think?
It is, yes. I mean, apart from anything else, it's totally irrelevant to the reality of the GRC as it was and as it is proposed to be.
Can you just tell us what GRC is?
Oh, the Gender Recognition Certificate, which, as a result of a ruling by the EHRC, have I got that right? Yes. Back about 15 years ago, the UK was obliged to come into line with other countries to... provide the final formal legal recognition of trans people in their adopted identities. We have been able to obtain modified birth certificates to correspond with our identity.
I mean, if basically, once you've started that transition and that journey, it's fairly easy to change your name on your passport and your driving licence, that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So, and I think one of the bones of contention that people are talking talking about is this idea, self-identification.
Yes, it's so a very emotive term, self-ID, isn't it? As though you can, you know, someone is at the pub and they think, right, just for bunts, I'll self-ID as a woman and then I'll go off on a rampage.
It's not that easy, though, is it, surely?
Not at all, it's nonsense. Trans identities are ultimately they rest upon self-identification. Nobody other than the person themselves knows what they are. Historically, there is a lot of interaction with the medical profession in order to obtain perhaps things that people feel the need for, medical interventions.
If we go back a little bit,
yes.
And we'll see that Labour was very prominent in introducing the Equalities Act,
yes.
Protected characteristics, etc. And then following on from that, the 2004 Gender Recognition Act, I mean, it was here it is, it's wonderful, this is what we're all working towards, which is an evolving of our understanding of these things, but it now needs tweaking. I mean, as it stands, this very intrusive and very expensive and 2-year in your role as your gender identity before you can get anywhere near the idea that you can actually get a certificate,
yes.
Is quite a long process. And I, as far as I understand it, lots of countries like Malta and Argentina and Ireland and Portugal, all these people that want to self-identify, which is what has happened all the time.
Yes.
It's been an easier process, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I mean, again, self-ID, it sounds emotive, but it is a system that we have in place already. And the scaremongering that comes with it, I think, is... the reality is that the hypothetical predator that these people are talking about would not do what trans people do in order to to get what is feared.
Yes.
Yes, because why would you?
Well, no.
You know, you don't. You know, for me, the sequence, as it were, of changing my legal identity was obtaining signing an
affidavit, sort of a legal.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
My legal change of name, and then progressively all my documentation, you know, bank accounts, passport, all these things. These enabled me, you know, to function in an administrative capacity.
To live your life and
yes.
get on with it. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It's all self-ID.
Okay, but can I just intervene for a second? Because I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What happens if someone comes along to you, Drew, and says, well, actually, no, you're not a woman, even though it says so on your birth certificate. No, you're a man. Is that hate speech?
It's it depends on what they do. I can't alter what people think or about me, and I can't force them to accept. But if that attitude impinges itself in how they act in relation to me, then it can veer into that territory, obviously.
And what originally made you decide to actually go to get a birth certificate? Why was it so important to you?
Sort of an element of legal protection, I suppose, and just the completion of the transition. Not everyone feels a need to go that far, but it does. Without that final change, you know, the birth certificate, then there are some protections which historically have not been afforded a trans person.
But
you know?
I mean, one of the concerns.
A second, Mel.
Yes.
So it's one other question I wanted to ask, mm-hmm. and that is about marriage, because, I mean, we have understood the word marriage to mean between a man and a woman,
yes.
for, I suppose, I don't know how many thousands of years. This is quite new, isn't it, for humanity to take this idea on board that marriage might be between a woman and a woman, or a man and a man, or a transgender man and a heterosexual woman, or whatever, you know. So it might be, this is becoming a bit confusing for a lot of people, I think.
Yes, I think that might be a slight red herring in the sense that, but as you do say, as you suggest, having a gender recognition certificate allows you, yes, without that you couldn't marry. You can now marry, of course, as a same-sex couple, but prior to that legislation, without the GRC, you would not have been able to marry somebody in your adopted gender.
You can now.
Yes, you can, yes.
So that is a red herring.
So that is a...
Yeah. So, but one of the other concerns that are raised about women's safe spaces. Now, I know that there have always been exceptions to that because, you know, we're talking about domestic violence and women's refuges. So that's very much on an individual basis, isn't it? So case-by-case basis. So I don't think those safeties have been touched at all. But I think
as I understand it, most, if not all, women's refuges have been accepting of trans women.
Yes, that's right. But the other concern, I suppose, is the idea that with the stats and about being registered as male-female, I know that lots of local authorities, and maybe Fabian will have something to say on this, because as our understanding is evolving about gender of and the spectrum of gender, then we're having different places and spaces that are actually welcoming to all, you know, non-binary or whatever. And some local authorities are getting it wrong. I did see a very funny thing for Essex County Council, who they actually had a sort of motif of which made no difference anyway, because you could prefer not to say, but they had a little sort of cartoon picture of, there was a very stereotypical woman with her thumbs up, and a very stereotypical man with his thumbs up, and then a third little picture that you could tick if you were transgender, and it was somebody scratching their head and pulling off a wig. So that, I mean, that seems a bit odd, doesn't it?
That's a bit
clueless.
That's clueless. Yes. That's really bad taste.
Yes. But also, I mean, you're talking there about the spectrum of gender. Mm. I mean, isn't gender just male or female?
Well, we all are starting to realise that gender is a social construct these days. You know, I mean, people don't fit into that idea of what a
is. Is it not a physical thing at all, gender? I mean, you're saying it's
no,
a social contract.
No, I don't think it is, actually. No? What do you think, Drew?
It's a tricky one. I mean, what we mean by gender is evolving, you know, drastically. My old copy of Fowler's English Usage is very austere and says it's merely a grammatical term, but obviously we've come on a long way since then. I think claiming that gender is a social construct is a very easy thing for people to say, and a lot of people do. It's not that simple. There is a lot of overlap between the one and the other. I mean, I generally used to think that my simple thing, sex is what we are, gender is how we perform or interact with other people. But as I say, they are interconnected. And furthermore, just dismissing something as a mere social construct is slightly disingenuous, since we are social creatures. We function socially.
Fabian, what's the City Council, if anything, doing about this? Or isn't it? Do you know?
Well, obviously we've got the debate going on in the party, and obviously Labour introduced, you know, started the ball rolling nationally with the civil partnerships that then moved into equal marriage. So we've got we got rid of Section 28.
Yeah,
which
but it's not just hang on, because it's not just a debate, is it? You're starting to exclude people from standing as candidates that have got certain views. That's not really a debate. That's
right.
After a debate has happened and you've already decided, it seems to me, that certain people who have certain views are not going to be allowed to be Labour candidates.
Right, we were both at that meeting, weren't we?
Yes, we were. It was a meeting that was carried out, we mentioned it last week, didn't we, that was carried out in a perfectly sort of democratic way. There were certain people that put forward, normally we would just vote through in a block, couldn't we, because lots of people are sort of sitting councillors anyway.
This was the first, normally it is just the rubber stamping at the meeting of, you know, this is the list of candidates, because basically if you want to be a Labour candidate for council, you have to get approved onto a panel, so you have to apply, and then you have to sort of list, you know, provide a sort of a CV of what you've been up to, what you've done, or your experience. You then have to be interviewed, and that's usually chaired by someone outside of Bristol, so there's some independence and neutrality in it. And if you pass that, then you'll go onto the list of approved candidates. You then go to the local campaign forum, which is the part of the party that is responsible for organising the council elections in Bristol, and other parts of the country will have their own local campaign forums as well.
So a couple of people, Labour people, were put forward, and some people objected to them because it's a very small pocket of people that they like to describe themselves as gender critical, but they're very concerned women who are concerned about the idea of, you know, women's safe spaces and all the protection of our children and that kind of thing. And but one of the things that these particular people, apart from they do misgender people, which is actually quite offensive and discourteous, but they do deliberately do that.
The Defence at the moment.
I know,
well,
so which is not, you know, it's not on.
Good.
But basically, one of the things that's
so they'll call someone who's a transgender woman, they'll call them a man.
Yeah, they'll try and say they're not. They'll say you're not a woman, and
but
things
it's
like
not
that,
just
even
that,
though
it's
they've completely completed the process and.
Yeah, referring to an old name that doesn't apply anymore or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But one of the things that is objected to, and I would really like to clear this one up, is a relatively new introduction into how we talk about ourselves as trans women and cis women. And lots of people don't understand that. And it's just a Latin term. And for instance, I'm a cis woman, which means that I was assigned female at birth. I was born natally a female or whatever.
And I'm a cis man.
And you're a cis man. So basically, I would only say that if I was talking about trans and cis, otherwise I'm just a woman. And one of the things that's basically, this is the fact of it, that as a cis woman, I am a woman who can never be a trans woman. And a trans woman is a woman who can never be a cis woman.
But what if you change your mind?
Sorry?
What if you change your mind?
I don't think I would, actually. I think people generally know quite early on, don't they? But one of the things that I did want to talk about was this really, what happens is as soon as you start this policing of gender at toilets and spaces and things, because we don't normally look under people's skirts or whatever, I just wanted to just pass on this story of a friend of mine who, she's a very statuesque, tall, beautiful, she's a musician, and she has a fabulous figure and wears wonderful model clothes, and she said to me, something terrible happened to me, Mal. I said, what was that? And she said, well, I do get mistaken as a trans woman. I said, do you? It never occurred to me, actually. She said, look at me. I'm very tall. I have big hands and feet and a very deep voice. And I said, but you just look like a statuesque, beautiful woman to me. She said, well, people do. And she said, and I went to the loo the other day, the ladies, in a public place, and a very tough-looking woman came charging after me and actually tried to physically manhandle me, called me a tranny, which is a very offensive term, and tried to manhandle me out of the toilet. I said, oh my goodness, what did you do? If it had been me, I would have probably raised my skirt immediately, but that probably wasn't appropriate because this lady was quite a tough sort of looking type. But she said, what I realised was I should have said, yes, I am, and so, you know. So, but it's this kind of like, we don't want to have that because we're all on the same side.
Yes, okay. The sort of thing is actually increasing, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm. I know a lot of cis women who have had hostile responses going into loos because they are themselves, you know, they choose not to be stereotypically feminine.
Yeah.
Can you just say something? Because apparently there's a book been written about you, Drew. Man, yes. What's this book?
Yes, it's great, actually, because it should be your sort of definitive book, because it's written by a quite a famous chap called Richard Beard. And he's a friend of Drew's, and for years and years and years, they always went for a fortnight's while camping together off a dyke, 2 weeks, and the story is about many journeys on many different levels. It's very funny. It makes you want to go camping, but it's the definitive book on how some people go on this journey and start on this journey and the reasons behind it and the reasons for asking behind it. And it's now a library book that's taken out an awful lot, actually, and I do think it's a very wonderful awareness raising one. It's called Becoming Drew. Who's it published by?
It's Becoming Drusilla, that's my full name,
right.
Which only comes out for the courts. Yes.
Yeah. Becoming Drusilla, and it's written by Richard Beard, and it's published by?
Harvill and Secker, I think.
Ah.
I'm a bit rusty on that.
All right, well, Drew Marlon, thanks ever so much for coming in and sharing your experience with us. Let's go on now, though, to look at the death of Albert Finney, just announced today. And I've been rather frustrated, even just on the Comcast News at 6 there, we heard reference to two films he was in, Aaron Brockovich and Annie. Well, of course, they are not by any means the most brilliant films he was in. He was a part of the New Age, I suppose you'd call it, or kitchen sink dramas of the 1960s. Let's have a listen now, because, of course, the most famous film, the film that made him as an actor, was called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning.
Another few more, and that's a lot for a Friday. £14.03 and tuppence for 1,000 of these a day. No wonder I've always got a bad back. I'll soon be done. I'll have a fag in a bit. No use working every minute God sends. I could get through in half the time if I went like a bull, but they'd only slash me wages so they can get stuffed. Don't let the bastards grind you down, that's one thing I've learned. Jack's one that ain't learnt it. He wants to get on. Yes, Mr. Robbo. No, Mr. Robbo. I'll do it as soon as I can, Mr. Robbo. And look where they got Robbo. A fat gut and lots of worry. Fred's all right. He's one of them who knows how to spend his money, like me. Enjoys himself. That's more than them poor beggars know. They got ground down before the war and never got over it. I'd like to see anybody try to grind me down, that'd be the day. What I'm out for is a good time. All the rest is propaganda.
What I'm out for is a good time. All the rest is propaganda. That's what I'm really looking forward to saying that tonight, actually. But Fabian, I know back when that first came out, I think you were saying just before we came in here, it was an X certificate.
Yeah, apparently it was. It came out in about 1960s. It was an X. It's now it's now PG. I saw it at the Watershed some years back on a reissue.
It says so many things.
It's a fantastic film. Absolutely brilliant film.
From Saturday Night Sunday Morning. It says so many things, not only about the change in what's acceptable, the idea that it was an X film back then and now it's a PG, but it says quite a lot also about the quality of the films in our cinemas. I mean, that was an absolutely gripping piece of cinema. I mean, I don't know, I've hardly seen anything apart from maybe I, Daniel Blake. There's one or two films now, Mel, but what's happened to the film industry?
I know, it's all become a bit more corporate and commercialised, hasn't it? And we follow things in a way that... I mean, when I think about things that were commissioned years ago and in the 60s that turned into wonderful classic things, they would never be commissioned these days. Things like... I'm going into comedy now. Things like Monty Python, that would never be commissioned these days, and it's become a classic, isn't it?
Especially Monty Python and the Holy Grail. That is the best Monty Python film. In my opinion, that's the best Monty Python film ever. Brilliant.
But it's all changed, and also it's this insidious creeping in to the commissioning people, the people with the money, you know, that it's kind of like an endless circle and cycle of feeding the masses with what, you know, is going to attract advertising.
It's sequels,
that kind
and
of thing.
Reboots, and it's just so frustrating. I mean, I love films, and I go to the cinema a fair bit, and I saw Green Book, which was the one... that's on at the moment. I think it's called Green Book, about a white, slightly racist driver who's employed to take a black pianist, part of a musical trio, around the southern United States in the early 60s. So while there's still the race bars and on all of that, and that was a really good, entertaining film, and it really made you think. It's based on a true story of two guys who... The two guys in reality became lifelong friends. Were friends until...
Okay, who is watching Cleaning Up on Wednesdays on ITV? Anybody?
No.
If you haven't been watching it, give it a watch. It's nice to see.
Oh yes, it's about those women, the cleaners, isn't it? That are picking up some other interesting...
It's a tad unrealistic.
Oh, of course, you would never be able to get insider dealing information by earwigging on offices in the City of London. And of course, if anything like that was to happen, the police would immediately arrest you.
Well, they've been filming in Bristol quite a lot lately. And one of the things is the Christine Keeler Profumo thing, isn't it? So, you know, there's always that very closely aligned people in politics. We're on the politics show, and people, you know, sort of being able to whistleblow or to reveal sort of certain things. There are very lots of things at the moment that a bit like the Lloyd's building, money seems to be able to cover up investigations and scandals, doesn't it?
Okay.
And that one's a classic.
Let me try and work with
the
Profumo case really did it, because they did that film in 1989, Scandal, which had John Hurt in it, and
yes,
that was an absolutely stunning film. So I'd be interested to see what this new series,
the new film is
like.
Anyway, it's nice to know there's a bit of decent drama around. Well done, ITV. Big clap. BBC, thumbs down. You know, no, Downton Abbey, part 705. Maybe that's going to be... hopefully they'll scrap that completely.
Does anyone remember Being Human? It was filmed... The first few series were filmed Bristol, which were amazing. And then they moved it, relocated, because they moved their drama department from Bristol out to Cardiff.
Yeah.
And the series they did after that were nothing like as good, and the series just petered out. But the first few series filmed in Bristol were just brilliant.
The reason I sort of know a bit about it is because my eldest son is actually a location manager for those kind of things. So he was doing that, and he did the Being Human one as well. And one day he phoned me up and said, "Mum, do you want to be a bank-robbing pensioner?" And I said, "Oh, yes, please." So we appeared in this film called Golden Years. And, of course, it's still rather relevant. It was made for Netflix and the American audience, etc. But it's rather relevant today because it was about these poor pensioners pensioners who had their pensions all kind of like disappeared, and so they turned into. Did you ever see it? It was fantastic.
I didn't see it.
There's plenty of pensioners that are having their pensions disappeared now and finding
exactly
that when they thought they were going to get paid when they were 65, oh no, it's going to be 66, 67, 68. Isn't that robbery? Avon and Somerset Police, are you listening?
Yes, I mean, lately they slipped through, didn't they? The fact that if you are a couple and one of you is under pensionable age, then you don't get pension credit. You're stuck with the bedroom tax thing as well. So that's going to cause people are going to have to get
and
divorced.
Also the pensions,
aren't they?
Our pensions in this country are the worst of the West. Most other countries can afford far more generous pensions. They must be able to afford it somehow.
The Dutch are the best, aren't they?
Yes.
Look, before
yes.
we get off completely off the subject of film, Mal, another thing, I think we were chatting just before we were coming in, you were saying some fascinating stuff about your family history.
Oh, yeah.
About the 1930s dance band music. So give us a little insight into...
Well, my father was a famous band leader of the 30s called Reginald Williams and the Futurists, and he brought Al Bowie to Bristol in 1936. And it was funny because we've got the now what's the wonderful thing that's happening? Paul McGann's got the silent movie thing. What's it called?
Slapstick Festival.
And so it's been in the news lately about when Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy came to Bristol. And I remember as a child, it was 1953 and I was born in 52, but there was a wonderful picture of my mum sitting on Stan Laurel's knee when they came that time. And he was quite a sensual, serious man, and he really fell for my mum. She used to look like Rita Hayworth, and so she's quite a glamorous-looking person.
Have you seen the film Stan and Ollie?
I haven't seen it.
It's about that. It's about that trip. I strongly recommend it. I saw it. There's a bit of it that's filmed actually in Bristol. It's the back entrance of the Hippodrome actually doubles up as the entrance to the Queen's Hall in Newcastle. I don't think the Queen's Hall was anything like that. But anyway, that's... They have actually filmed
okay.
couple scenes
that's,
actually in
that's
Bristol.
That's the film review show over. Now, back to
politics.
The politics show. And actually, we haven't even mentioned Brexit yet, but we're going to go back now to the year 1975. Britain had been in the European Economic Community, the Common Market, the EEC, for 2 years. We'd been signed in by Edward Heath, who was the Conservative Prime Minister, and the Labour Prime Minister, who was Harold Wilson, decided they were going to have a referendum on it. That was the first EEC referendum, which took us into the European Union. So I thought we'd have a listen now to Michael Foote, who was a Labour spokesperson on it, and Ted Heath, the former Conservative Prime Minister, speaking in 1975 about the rights and wrongs of the European Economic Community and Brussels.
The greatest problem in our democratic modern societies is how...
That's Michael Foote starting off.
...communities work, and people owe an allegiance to those who make the laws. The further you remove away from the people the place where those laws are made, the less likely it is that they're going to be obeyed. The more you weaken the strength of the system of democratic consent. So that's why I'm afraid of it. That's where Mr. Heath would lead us. That's what he signed in 1973. It's coming much slower, maybe, than he expected then, and than Willy Brandt and others want. Willy Brandt is quite open about the matter. He's absolutely honest. He says he wants to go for a federal authority, and he translates the economic and monetary union into the actual fact of the matter. And I believe that before June the 5th, it would be a great advantage in the honesty of the whole of this referendum campaign if Mr. Heath and the leading champions, the pro-marketeers, were openly to admit that economic and monetary union, such as he put his name to, this country's name, although he didn't have the right to do that, but he put his name to it in 1973, that the programme for economic and monetary union does mean a federal state, does mean the establishment of a kind of super state in Western Europe, and then let the people choose whether that's what the British people want.
Does it mean those things?
No, it doesn't at all. And there's therefore no reason why I should admit anything of the kind.
That's Edward Heath.
It is Michael Foote's inability to understand new institutions and to think that in Europe we've got to model ourselves on the United States or the Soviet Union or Australia or Canada or New Zealand. That is not going to happen. When they started either from scratch or, as the Soviet Union did, after a revolution. And as far as we're concerned, we've got 9 states in the community, most of which are old nation states. Not the case with ERA, but the others have got very long individual histories, and they are not going to have a federal arrangement. And what Michael Foot cannot understand is that you have the ministers, whether it's heads of government or foreign secretaries or finance ministers, meeting together. They have their powers, but they are limited powers, and they can only act if the government and the parliament of their own country agrees. Now, that covers everything. And Michael Foot has been saying, of course, we've still got so much to come in which we're going to be bound hand and foot. There is nothing to come.
That was former Prime Minister Edward Heath in 1975, just before the referendum that took us into the EEC. Fabian, if I'm allowed to say it, the boot's on the other foot now, isn't it? Because it's really the Conservative Party that's leading the charge out, whereas in the old days, the Labour Party was saying we shouldn't be joining, at least the majority were at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Labour switched its policy to more pro-Europe with, I believe, under the leadership of Neil Kinnock. But, I mean, up to that point, it had always been a Eurosceptic party. But what's interesting is that Michael Foot was talking about economic union, and, of course, we have the euro in Europe and things like that. So, and Ted Heath was, you know, I was just thinking in the back of my mind, you know, sort of Tory fibs, because they're saying, oh, it's nothing's, you know, that I'm not saying that in a sort of Eurosceptic manner. I'm just saying that, you know, that Mr. Heath was being a little bit economical with where things were going. I'm not saying that's good or bad. You know, where things have gone with Europe is necessarily good or bad. I think it needs reform. But it's, you know, we're now in the situation with Brexit. The referendum was purely called to settle, you know, scores within the Conservative Party. David Cameron thought he could win it. Both sides ran a deplorable campaign. We then voted leave. Cameron and Co did a runner, and the rest is history.
Well, when you say that, I mean, there's an interesting Guardian article, isn't there, from just, I don't know if you'd seen it, from just around the same time as the referendum, this latest referendum, saying that talking about the demographics where the Brexit vote was won. Who and what led the Leave campaign to the startling win that will likely redefine British politics? Also worth remembering that we were told, oh, no, the polls are all saying we're going to vote Remain. We didn't. We voted to leave. The average educational attainment, median income and social class in English local authorities were the strongest predictors of how residents in that area voted in the referendum. So basically having bad education and low income was those areas had tended to vote Brexit, which has been rather nastily sort of spun to the public through the mass media as well. Uneducated people vote for Brexit. But anyway, what do you make of the clip from 1975, Mal?
How times change, don't they?
Don't they?
I don't think you can compare too much with the situation then and now, because did Ted Heath mention 9 countries? We're now 27 member states, isn't it? And I think the whole European unity and the struggles with the power and everything has been evolving all along. But I do think that the benefits that we've enjoyed from being a major member country have far outweigh the idea of being outside of it, I must
okay.
say.
We're going to talk, okay, just hang on a second, because we're going to talk about the backstop now, because this backstop seems to be the major sticking point. And I thought it'd be interesting to get the perspective of the Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar on his take on it all.
The border between Northern Ireland and Ireland isn't just a border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. It's also going to be the new EU-UK frontier.
No.
So this isn't just a question for Ireland. It's not just a question of maintaining the peace process, protecting the Good Friday Agreement, although that is the overriding objective and has to be. It is also a question of making sure that we protect the single market and the customs union, and that Ireland doesn't become a backdoor to the single market and the customs union. So if at some point in the future the United Kingdom were to allow chlorinated chicken or beef with hormones into it, into their markets, we wouldn't want that coming into our markets or the European Union as well.
Yeah, he has a point. I mean, the whole thing that was missing from the whole Brexit campaign and debate was the whole issue of the Northern Ireland peace process, the Good Friday Agreement, which is interesting when you think about it. It started under John Major, a Conservative, and then it was completed by Tony Blair, led, you know, with a lot of work from Senator Mitchell and, of course, the late and great Mo Molem.
In fact, she was the one that invited Jeremy Corbyn to come and help with that process, so he was good part of that as well.
Yeah, exactly. So this is an...
Be aware that there are articles out there. I'm not saying which is true and which isn't. I'm afraid, able to do that. But some people are saying that actually there's no reason that the there can't be a hard Irish border in the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, all I'm saying is that if you have a look in the Belfast Telegraph, for example, and the Irish Times, there are legal arguments that say that this is a fantasy. That the main problem seems to be the DUP can't decide which border they want if there's going to be a border. I mean, maybe I'll just ask both of you. If you were the DUP, what would you do? Because they don't seem to be able to make their mind up as to whether they want a border with Southern Ireland or with England. And they surely have got to have one or the other, haven't they?
Well, isn't there much talk about some sort of digital border that doesn't exist? A virtual border that exists somewhere in the Irish Sea.
So little cameras kind of up in the sky, drones kind of watching it? What's that?
Who knows? But I mean, the actual traffic that goes from Northern to Irish and backwards and forwards is actually quite small. So there's a bit of a political stuff going on. I mean, nobody mentioned Gibraltar, for goodness sake, did they?
I know, and Gibraltar's almost got a hard border, even though, you know, because... back in about 2003-04, we went over to the Costa del Sol and got a coach trip into Gibraltar, and trying to get over the border between Spain and Gibraltar took forever.
Was that the Spanish making things difficult?
It was the Spanish making things difficult, and coming back, we actually had to get off the coach, walk through customs, and then get on the coach the other side of...
So this is the question, is if there is a hard border between Northern and Southern Ireland, do you think that will reignite some kind of war?
It's not worth the risk.
It's not worth the risk. We can never have a hard border again. I know people and I have friends who lived in those days when there was, and you know, it's just not, we've come so far, to go backwards is the most terrible idea, isn't it?
I just feel desperately, desperately sorry for how this is impacting on the whole island of Ireland, whether it's the people who live in the North or the people who live in the Republic. It's just, you know, it's just an absolute disaster, and I'm really, really...
Another little thing about Brexit has emerged this week, which is a interview with Jeremy Corbyn, I don't know if you've seen it, you two, from 2009, which was the second of the two referenda that Ireland had over the EU Constitution. Well, on the EU Constitution, the Irish voted 53.1% against it, and so that was on the 12th of June 2008. So on the 2nd of October 2009, they had another referendum to alter the Irish Constitution, and then they changed the name of it. It wasn't about the EU Constitution anywhere. It was called the Lisbon Treaty, which the Irish people ended up voting 67.1% in favour of. So this is why I think a lot of people say, well, what's the point of keep having referendums until you get the result that you want? That's exactly what they did in Ireland. Anyway, there was an interview with Jeremy Corbyn circulating around this week with his which is a speech that he gave over in Ireland just before the second of those two referenda. So let's have a listen to that now.
If you succeed in getting a no vote here, that will be such a boost to people like us all over Europe that do not want to live in a European empire of the 21st century. I'm pleased you're having a referendum. I wish we were having a referendum in Britain. I obviously hope and believe that the Irish people will vote no in October. But don't scrap your posters, don't recycle them, because you're going to need them for a third referendum. Because I've just got a feeling they're going to keep on voting until they get the answer they want. I remember that day, just like Thomas, when the last Irish referendum result came through in the British Parliament, the ministers started saying, we're going to have to look again at this. Hang on, what business of the British Parliament is it how the Irish people decide to vote? What it does is creates this military machine, this military Frankenstein, which will be so damaging to...
So a military Frankenstein, he calls the EU, is creating a military Frankenstein. He tells the Irish people they've got to vote no to the Lisbon Treaty, and he's talking about this dangerous European empire, Mel.
That was then, and this is now, and things have changed enormously.
He's just completely changed his mind in 10 years.
No, I mean, do allow people to evolve and change as things change. You know, now we're in a completely different situation, and I think it's quite unfair to compare one with t'other, actually. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn's principles have changed at all. He's a man who wants peace. He's always fought for peace. And I think he's been as true to his principles all along. And I think I'd much rather talk about referendum, actually, because, this, you know, in Switzerland, they have four referendums a year. They're always advisory, and when they vote against something, it's not because they don't like the idea, like the unconditional universal benefits that went 75-25, and it went back not because they don't like it, which is spreading marvellously now, isn't it? It's because they wanted more detail and more design. So the idea
Fabian,
that,
let's just see what Fabian's got to say about that. What we heard from Corbyn there, he's saying it's we should vote no to the Lisbon Treaty because that would need a change to the Irish Constitution. He's also talking about a dangerous European empire, and he's talking about a military Frankenstein to come. What has changed in those 10 years to make Jeremy Corbyn's mind turn around 180 degrees?
Well, I agree with Mel. He's entitled to change his mind, and things do change. And
some people say he hasn't really changed his mind. He actually is a bit of a Eurosceptic, really, and he's been sort of strong-armed into being more of a Remainer by his MPs, who are mostly Blairites.
Well, I mean, can I say here that in actual fact he's much more interested in people expressing what they want. And as he quite rightly said, you know, what business have we with how the Irish want to conduct their own business?
Yeah, that's fair enough.
And that's fair enough, isn't it?
The issue is what's right for us, what's going to work for us as Britain.
And he very, very clearly has said, and it was passed a conference with the motion, to remain in order to reform. And that's not changed, and all the options are on the table.
Well, I mean, if you'd have talked about a military Frankenstein back in 2009, people would have laughed at you. But we've now got the Germans and the French now talking about a single European army and both pushing for it. I mean, we're talking about the German Chancellor Merkel and Macron saying we do actually want a European army, please.
Well,
if we want...
Do you want a European army?
If we want to stop it, we probably need to be in the EU arguing against
having a voice, exactly.
Or making sure that it's a federal thing, so that if, say, a number of European countries decide that they want to do some peacekeeping work, then those that opt decide, yeah, we're into doing this peacekeeping work somewhere, go and do it. And if other countries think, nah, we think this is going to get messy and we're going to stay out of it, they can stay out of it, and that's fine.
And the idea of a soft Brexit that's so soft that you have all of those things that we enjoy now, but the only thing that you don't have is your voice.
One of the biggest,
any power to change anything.
I mean, the problem with May's deal, it's the worst of all worlds. It's worse than a hard Brexit because we're stapled to Europe, and it's worse than staying in because we don't have a voice. So we're having to pay, we're stapled to Europe, and we don't have a voice.
This is what they say about Norway. That's why they say this about Norway, is that they're having to pay loads of money, but they don't really have any voice.
That's why now, with hindsight, it looks like we should have a people's vote, have a reconsider.
It's the timing.
And rethink, is this really the way we want to go?
There's one real problem with having a people's vote, as you call it, a second referendum,
mm-hmm.
and that is that that would possibly extend another 2 years of uncertainty. One thing's for sure is the City of London do not want that. What they're saying is, you have got to get on with this. So I thought it might be useful to have a listen to, as I said earlier, Mark Carney, the Governor of the Bank of England, who actually, he is the person who, after this whole Brexit business, is going to be the person who decides whether we succeed or not here in Britain, making sure that there is the money to build industries because we can't import stuff anymore, or it's too expensive to. So let's see what Mark Carney had to say this week. I used to call Mervyn King, who was the previous governor of the Bank of England, King Mervyn, because I liked him. I'm not quite so keen on Carney, and you'll maybe see why after this. This is what he had to say this week.
The fog of Brexit is creating tensions in financial markets. Those markets remain sensitive to Brexit-related news, and a variety of risk premia on UK assets are elevated. Given the wide range of potential scenarios and the various paths to them, it would be remarkable if the current levels of sterling and other UK financial asset prices were consistent with the outcome that finally emerges. Now, how these tensions are reconciled once the fog lifts will have consequences for the path of monetary policy in ways that cannot be predicted in advance. And to forecast the economy and set monetary policy accordingly, the MPC must make a series of judgments and assumptions. And first on the judgments, given the dynamics of the negotiations, we are now assuming uncertainty remains elevated for a while and that financial conditions stay tighter for longer. Second, we have downgraded our forecast for UK-weighted global GDP, so the bit of global growth that matters for UK exporters, by 0.5%, and that's material. Over the past year, the global economy has transitioned from robust, broad-based expansion to a widespread slowdown, with all major regions currently decelerating in the wake of tighter financial conditions and rising trade tensions.
Okay, so that is a bit gobbledygook, really, let's be honest. But what he's actually saying there is if the longer that this uncertainty goes on for, the worse things are going to be. I mean, the basic headlines that have come from that speech that London journalists have put out are things like Britain faces weakest growth in a decade because of Brexit uncertainty. Mark Carney warns no deal is increasingly likely and could spark a recession. But then others say that he's always wrong, whatever he says, Fabian.
Well, I mean, this is the Tories' mishandling of Brexit ever since the referendum result came in has already cost us billions in the economy anyway.
So why didn't Labour sign up to the deal then? I mean, that would bring certainty, wouldn't it? Theresa May's deal.
Because it's worse than staying, and it's worse than leaving on hard Brexit.
Because it's
worse
an awful staying. Deal, of
it's
course.
It's a shocking deal.
Yeah,
and
shocking.
We shouldn't. You know, we've got our six criteria. Jeremy Corbyn has written to May and said that there are a number of things that would need to be changed.
Acting in the country's best interest, which, you know, the Tories don't do that.
And what's
do they?
Interesting is the European leaders are actually saying they'd rather deal with Corbyn than deal with May. And there you have it. I mean, you know.
Okay, so, I mean, it does bother me, Carney, a little bit, because if he really wanted to, I'm sure he could use a bit of this QE money. He keeps spending these hundreds of billions of pounds of quantitative easing, although apparently the Bank of England are now just letting that roll over. They're not doing any new QE. They're just replacing the bonds that they've issued. When they run out, they're just buying new ones. So they're keeping it sort of ticking over. But
we seem to be having socialism for big business and the super rich, while the rest of us are having to fend for ourselves, you know.
So what would you be saying to Carney if you had his ear, Fabian?
I think the uncertainty is caused by the way this whole thing has been handled, and so the uncertainty, we need basically competence in how we deal with whether we leave, whether we stay. It needs to be handled competently, and that isn't happening at the moment, and I don't think May is capable.
But we're going to get a recession, apparently. We're going to get a recession.
If we have a recession, we have a WTO,
we just leave on the 29th. Well, can I just ask you, what you think is going to happen on the 29th of March?
Well, hopefully we will delay pause Article 50, and actually get our heads together and try and work out what we actually want as a country.
I mean,
and that means rethinking our whole attitude.
Isn't that just more uncertainty? I mean, that's what Carney's saying here. It's the uncertainty.
A bit of uncertainty now, if it averts disaster, if it means we actually either get a sensible Brexit or we have a people's vote and we decide to remain, that's better. If we have a people's vote and we decide again to leave, and people know what that means, and they know that, okay, there's no deal or no deal has been agreed, so therefore we're going to have to leave on WTO, and they vote for that, then, okay, there may be churn, there may be some difficulties, but at least if people know what they're getting,
now,
they
what's
did
going to happen?
Time, that's
no
the
deal has got to be off the table.
Yeah, I agree.
I tell you, nothing's going to happen much because it can't happen, and so therefore there's a few options open. People are talking about a delay, but the point is that a delay for... it's been 3 years already. What good is that going to do?
What about Brexit songs? Any ideas?
Brexit songs?
Yeah, any thoughts for what songs might you be playing?
How about Highway to Hell after what Toss said?
If you leave me now, you take away the rest.
We'll have another go at that after the news. So that's Fabian Breckles, St George Troopers Hill Labour councillor, and Labour activist Mal Sainsbury. We'll be back after the news, looking at some of the international stories.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.